All right, let's get our Friday afternoon set the right way, and that means Dennis is here for Health Naturally. Dennis, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mark. Very nice to be with you again.
Always is. So it beats the alternative, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
It does. Now, look, you've been presenting the Health Naturally program for many, many years now, and
yes.
You've sort of speaking a lot. One of the themes that comes up quite often is Western herbalism. And you'll be taking a look today at some herbs that are kind of the backbone of Western herbalism, some very popular in your very own practice.
Yeah, look, it'll be a fascinating topic to look at. What is Western herbalism?
Don't oversell it, mate.
And what are some of the key remedies? You'll be interested, listeners, to the three that I want to try to get through.
All right, we'll do our best. This could be a three-parter.
It could be.
You'll get into those three herbs yes. that really encapsulate
yep.
Western herbalism.
Yep.
But as an opening, how would you define Western herbalism?
Oh, look, Western herbalism is a system of natural medicine, obviously based on herbs, which separates itself from other traditions of herbal medicine, such as Chinese herbalism, Ayurvedic herbalism from India. There are many, systems of herbal medicine around the world. And we in Australia, for instance, have a number of those. We have Chinese herbal medicine here. We have an expanding Ayurvedic or Indian-based herbal medicine system here. But historically, we have had our own, which we call Western herbal medicine, which, to be simple, is essentially a blend of what we can refer to loosely as old world herbs, together with what we call New World herbs. Now, what do we mean by that? We mean Western herbalism today draws upon traditional herbs from Europe. Calendula, for instance, daisy, a lot of yarrow, a lot of herbs that took their usage in herbal medicine prior to the discovery of the New World, i.e. particularly America. Now, herbal medicine today in the West is a blend of the traditional herbs of Europe, which have been the backbone of European herbalism for millennia, essentially, combined with those remarkable herbal remedies that were characteristic of traditional medicine practiced by the American Red Indians. So what happened was when the white settlers moved to the United States, when the Quakers, for instance, moved to Pennsylvania, they were some of the first to take on board the knowledge that the American Red Indian had about healing plants. The Quakers were a unique group. It could talk a long time about them, but they were pacifists, didn't believe in violence. They left the UK, as a matter of personal survival, retreating from some of the restrictions of English religion and indeed from the English crown, and went from Plymouth to the New World, to Pennsylvania, settled there, won favour with the American Red Indians, unlike many of the subsequent Protestant people that went there, many of whom were very cruel to the American Red Indians. The Quakers, with their manifestation of the teachings of non-violence from the New Testament, became very significant friends and took on board some of the remarkable medicines that the Red Indians were using, and which the Red Indians, and I use that colloquial term, explained to them, and then that became incorporated into a system of herbal medicine, which I refer to as Western herbal medicine, the herbs of the old world, the calendulas, the mistletoes, the motherworts, those herbs that I use frequently from Europe. However, these days, part of what we call the Western herbal medicine tradition, which is mixing the old with the new. And the herbs that I want to talk about today, Mark, are essentially what I would consider to be three outstanding representatives of the Western herbal medicine tradition. Let me just say, in defence of that tradition, in my opinion, it is these days the best documented, the most scientifically explained and understood by virtue of the application of what we call plant chemistry to analysing many of the herbs. So the days when herb medicine was necessarily seen as just, oh, just folklore, just all in your head, so to speak. Those days are gone and gone forever, and I thank God that I had a bit to do in teaching initially in this country the basis of herbal medicine activity, surrounded with knowing something about its chemistry. So we have these days in the Western tradition great credibility. You would have heard me on a number of occasions, Mark, talk about the British Herbal Pharmacopoeia, for instance, as the Bible
of
modern herbal medicine, one of the greatest texts produced in 1983, still, in my opinion, the greatest production of traditional Western herbal medicine, documented from scientists, plant-based chemists, doctors, pharmacists, herbalists, British Herbal Pharmacopoeia. Now, in that, three of the remarkable remedies representative of what we call Western herbal medicine, which I want to say something about.
All right. We will continue with history naturally. I mean, health naturally.
I'm glad you're coming on board there. Rubbing off onto you.
And we will come through a couple of those. We'll try and get through three of those herbs, of course. Dennis, you've basically waltzed us through Western herbalism, some of the historical ten poles of it there.
Sure.
And we'll get into those three exciting herbs. One I know you talk about a little bit, and that is slippery elm.
I consider slippery elm to be the best representative of the Western herbal medicine tradition. The herb has its roots in American traditional medicine, which, as I said, was blended to the old world system. And I was looking at some of my notes and stuff before I came to the program today, and I looked at some old notes from the Dominion Herbal College that I used way, way back in the early 60s, in fact. And one of the writers in that made this comment about slippery elm. They said, "This tree grows extensively in both North and South America and is without doubt one of the finest and most valuable remedies in the herbal world, in inflammatory conditions of the stomach, lungs, intestines, and urinary organs. It is one of the most excellent agents that can be used." Now, that is old world language, but what it points out is the broad spectrum, soothing, if you want to use that term, soothing effect that this remarkable remedy have on so many different organs of the body. And rightly so. What I meant even yesterday, reflecting on my prescribing, the number of patients or clients that were already using slippery elm or were prescribed slippery elm is remarkable. I could not practice, and I doubt whether many other Western herbal medicine practitioners could practice effectively without harnessing the remarkable possibilities of slippery elm. Now, let me just explain how it works. I'll be simple. Slippery elm contains a slimy substance, if you want to call it that, which is released when the herb is soaked in cool or warm water. That slimy substance is called mucilage, and it passes through the system pretty well intact. And as it moves through the system, it has a soothing effect on all the membranes of the gut and other organs such as the urinary tract and the respiratory system. And the term soothing, therefore, is important because many, many people experience troublesome, irritable conditions, particularly of the gut. They experience reflux. They will experience even more serious conditions. They will experience problems in the lower part of the gut with anything ranging from constipation through to diarrhea. Many of them will have levels of inflammatory activity in the large bowel. All these conditions can be helped. Forget about the word cure. The word helped is better. The word manage is better. All of these conditions can experience the soothing effect of slippery elm. And for people that get particularly a lot of upper gut problems, sometimes where the conventional reflux drugs aren't doing the job or patients are reluctantly using them, I say to listeners, if you've not used slippery elm as a means of soothing the gut wall, stomach in particular, against inflammatory states, even as part and treatment of an ulcerative condition, then you could be missing out on one of the most remarkable effects that a herb could have on that part of the body. Let me just point out here, slippery elm is not just used by the practitioners of traditional medicine such as myself. It is increasingly being used by mainstream medicine. The number of my patients now that will say to me, oh, I discussed this with my doctor and my doctor said, well, look, perhaps you should try some slippery elm. It's coming into its own because it has a credible scientific and clinical basis to its soothing, supportive effect on many conditions, particularly of the upper gut.
All right. Now, I don't know if this applies to this particular herb, but I'm going to give it a crack anyway. I know quite often you say that taste and texture and all are important to how your body reacts to what we take. What's this one like to take? It's not a bitter herb.
No. It's not a bitter herb. It is a soothing herb, and mucilage is a very sweet substance.
That's some for lunch.
It's not as silly as it sounds because in the notes that I was looking at this morning, going back 100 years, slippery elm was turned into what was called a gruel, which is an old term for a porridge, and it was used essentially as a food, particularly for people who could not tolerate any other things. They could nearly all tolerate the use of slippery elm as a porridge or a gruel. So it is a sweet herb. It can be taken with honey. It can be taken on its own. It can be converted into a juice. It can be used with food. It can be taken even in an encapsulated form, although I prefer the use of the crude powder. Slippery elm comes as a powder. And if listeners get nothing more from my program today, please take on board the broad spectrum soothing effect that this very safe traditional remedy from the United States has on so many parts of the body. People that experience recurring urinary tract irritations, people that experience upset in their bowel function, diarrhea or constipation, people that experience gallbladder spasm and gallbladder colic. These situations can at least be alleviated, if not resolved, by the ongoing use of what I call a food herb, which is the herb slippery elm.
Oh, gee, you've really sold it well. It's soothing. You can have it with your lunch. You can have it in with your juice or whatever. It's pretty good. Dennis Stewart is here, and good afternoon to you, Patricia, at Currumbong. You have a question in relation to a bacteria in the gut. What's happening, Patricia?
I have got bacteria in the gut. I've got colitis, a few other things going on there. And I was just wondering if slippery elm would help. I've also got heart problems, and I've got tablets there.
Yes, of course.
Would it interfere with anything that I'm taking?
Look, slippery elm, let me emphasise, is a safe herb. Many, many people take it without any sort of medical prescription for it. They just take it. It can be purchased easily. There are very, very few people that I'm aware of that have become ill ever taking slippery elm. The only thing that I would say is that with any substance, including slippery elm, periodically one should perhaps give it a bit of a break so that if it is interfering with anything you're taking, you can usually pick up on that if and when you have the break. Plus also, after a break, going back onto a natural supplement, you can get, if you like, a kick start of the benefit that it might have. Depending upon the level of slippery elm, if it's an ordinary 5-gram dose of the powder, take it ideally, between meals if you're on prescription medication. In my view, there might be an advantage in taking it not directly when you take your pharmaceutical medication. Take it, say, an hour or a couple of hours after you've used what doctor has prescribed. That's a very safe way. But even there, that's being ultra cautious. I doubt whether it could interfere with antihypertensive medication that your doctor's prescribed. It is more of a food and very, very safe. And with your gut problem, which sounds to be an inflammatory gut problem, a combination of inflammation.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
Yeah. Well, look, I think the benefit of slippery elm, if you've not used it, you could be missing out on something. This is not to suggest in any way, by the way, Patricia, that you need to retreat from what your good doctor or specialist has prescribed.
Oh, no, no.
But it, like many natural remedies, it can work with and reinforce the action of many of the medications that we all depend upon. I would suggest you have a word with your GP at least, but I could see no reason why you couldn't experience some of its soothing effects. As far as the gut infection is concerned, another American herb that they'll talk about momentarily, the herb golden seal. Golden seal is to the gut wall a remarkable herb to work against, particularly where there are stubborn, chronic, low-grade pathologies or infections occurring in the gastrointestinal tract. For instance, a golden seal, with or without the use of slippery elm, functions very, very effectively in some levels of Helicobacter infection, where patients with peptic ulceration or ulceration of the stomach have not done well on the antibiotic medication and that particular pathology lingers. The chronic or the ongoing use of golden seal is remarkable for addressing the infection side of that condition. And I prescribe golden seal. And let me just emphasise here, this is not something for health food store proprietors to work with. If one is going to use golden seal, one needs to know how to use it properly, the medical conditions for which it is appropriate. And in my opinion, it is a herb that should be more used by a practitioner of either medicine or naturopathic medicine in order to be able to address the patient or the client's consider a condition more sensibly. This is not in any way at all to attack the retailer of golden seal, but where there is a medical condition, say something like an unresolved infection of the gut, and one is wanting to use something, golden seal with its antimicrobial chemistry is a very, very good medication, which I have proven in stubborn cases of Helicobacter to be effective. Combination of golden seal and slippery elm is something that most naturopaths, if they haven't tried it, should take on board. And I might just say I'm concerned about the way in which many naturopaths today, in my opinion, and not being taught some of the older herbs which built the profession and are becoming too dependent on some of the modern whiz-bang costly alternatives.
Thank you so much, Patricia. Dennis, I think that's just a quirk of our modern society, that everything new that's shiny is the way to go, and everything that's not, we just need to get rid of, dangerously so.
That's a very, very good question, Mark. One of the most lamentable things to me is to see the way in which the tradition of herbal medicine has been largely captured by the industry. And this may be an inevitable thing. Some aspects of it are good, but your point about glossy preparations and all that is true. And what comes with it, unfortunately, is usually an acceleration of cost and a missing out on some of the virtues that a simpler use of the crude, unprocessed herb can do a job sometimes competitively better. But look, I'm an old man. Perhaps I'm just whinging.
Good afternoon, Barbara. You're at Carrington. You have a question on ginseng today. What's the story, Barbara?
Yes, hi. Well, look, I've just been listening and I was going to be asking about ginseng, the two different types, Korean and Siberian. But the more I listen, the more questions I have for you after listening to everyone. Because I guess I was taking it for inflammation, the Korean, and the brain as well. Mm-hmm. In drop form.
I worry about that. Look, ginseng is not to be confused with golden seal. Golden seal, I would think, is more appropriate for what you've been talking about, but that's just an opinion. Ginseng is much more, in my opinion, one of those herbs which support the body when it's under physical or mental stress, and technically in our profession is called an adaptogen. That is a herb which, if used regularly, can enable the body to function more effectively, mentally and physically, particularly when it's under stress.
And
I believe if you see it as it's been seen in traditional Asian medicine, as a herb that resists some of the factors, some of the stressors that cause stress within the body, and stress within the body can lead to diseases, inflammation, lead to mental states. That's a good area where ginseng is used. I take a vial of ginseng daily as part of my routine, but again, I'm an old codger, but I think anyone who is an old codger should take note of what I said on the program. Some of the best examples of aging well I have seen in people whose life has been characterized by a regular ingestion of supplements, some of which have incorporated ginseng. I think that's how you should see ginseng, Barbara.
Yes, I found out I don't think I was taking enough of it either.
Well, you need to take it in a measured dose. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. And this comes back to my point about getting intelligent advice. Just walking into a supermarket and taking something off the shelf and using it ad hoc, yeah, look, I worry about that. I worry about that because sometimes, unless you take a product with an understanding of its minimum and maximum dosages, you can be just taking what I would consider to be lolly water and a retail product, when most of the herbs that I talk about, Barbara, are strongly medicinal.
Now, yes, if these were from a herbalist, though, mixed up in like in a 100ml bottle, and I would take 15 drops.
Well, that depending upon the concentration of the ginseng, that might be a good way of doing it. Ginseng is not what I would call a high dose herb. Therefore, the herbalist that you got it from is probably on the money there by prescribing it. Probably around a mil dose, 15 to 20 drops of a concentrated extract of ginseng is not a bad preparation. So that herbalist, I think, has done you a favour.
All right, best of luck with everything there, Barbara. We will move on to Wall's End and Judy. Bronchitis, you're after some recommendations there, Judy. What's the story for you?
Yes, hello.
Hello, Jenna. Judy. Hello.
Second bout of bronchitis this year.
Yes.
I had a UTI and sepsis last August.
Oh, dear, dear, dear.
And swollen feet and legs, which they diagnosed as reactive arthritis.
Yes.
And I just think my immune system is very low. It needs a good boost.
Yeah. Look, a couple of things. If we concentrate just very quickly on this wretched bronchitis, The way a medical herbalist would work here is, number one, to certainly improve the patient's natural resistance. Give them something that has a good reputation and some clinical and scientific evidence to support the way in which, when prescribed, the organ that's being assaulted, in this case by infection and inflammation, would function better and throw off more easily the infection that might be carrying on there. Two herbs, which any medical herbalist who knows his stuff would know about, would be directed towards a chronic settled bronchitis. One of those would be the herb Echinacea.
Oh, yes.
Echinacea is still not well understood, but it is very, very useful as an antimicrobial herb. That is a herb with an ability to address infection and in the right dosage. But it has been traditionally prescribed with an old world herb called elecampane, E-L-E-C-A-M-P-A-N-E. Elecampane is a herb that comes from the old world. It's blended with echinacea that comes from the new world. Those two herbs have traditionally been used as a combination to dress settled infections of the bronchial system. Usually they might be prescribed with a soothing herb, such as licorice or slippery elm or marshmallow, usually in a liquid preparation. But in addressing the bronchitis and the recurring infection history that you've had, the two herbs, I come back to it, echinacea and elecampane, and don't forget what I've said about golden seal, about its broad-spectrum action. It's not just limited to the gut. Golden seal can affect chronic urinary tract infections. It can help address infection in the bowel, and it can help with echinacea and elecampane in addressing respiratory conditions. There again, however, Judy, is justification of what I'm saying. In a medical condition like this, where herbs could work remarkably well, you really need to be seeing a therapist, a compounding pharmacist, a doctor that might be an integrated doctor using herbs, or people like myself who are qualified herbalists. Your condition, in my opinion, warrants a medical understanding of the herbs that I've mentioned in order to give you the result, which I believe you'd get.
Oh, okay. Yes, oh, that's very interesting. So what about, I heard you mention astragalus.
Yes, okay. Astragalus is what I consider to be very, very useful in building up one's general immunity. But where one's immunity has been reflecting itself in an infection state, in your case, like bronchitis, there you have to think of echinacea.
Okay.
I see astragalus as a very useful initial defence agent for people that keep going down with either viral or bacterial infections. But where, nevertheless, the individual goes down, say, with a condition that requires more immediate needs, that's where what I've said fits in, the use of echinacea and golden seal in particular.
Oh, very interesting. Mm. Oh, thank you very much, Dennis.
That's
I appreciate
pleasure.
Your help.
That's a good question. Thank you, Judy.
Dennis, I've got the bad news for you first. You want to cover three herbs today. You're only going to get through one.
What a pity.
There are weeks to come, though. Good afternoon for Bruce at Wall's End. You have a question for Dennis today. Bruce, you've got to get us off speakerphone, mate. It's going to be a bit hard to hear you.
Okay, I'll turn it off there now.
All right, so there we go. Much better.
Right, what I need to know, I've got bad sciatica.
Yes.
Really bad. I've got 8 to 10 pain, 24/7.
Okay. What has your doctor prescribed for you, Bruce?
They haven't really done much at all. I just bought, it come from the USA. It's called Healthy Lab. It's a belt, goes around my waist,
mm-hmm.
down around my butt cheek,
yeah.
down around the top of my leg between my groin and my knee.
Uh-huh.
It has helped a little bit, but my knee is like a soccer ball.
Oh, really?
And so is my calf. That's why I thought maybe I need to come and see you, let you have a look, see what you think.
Has your doctor seen the swelling?
Yep. She's a great doctor.
Of course.
But she hasn't done much at all.
Okay. Your blood test has not indicated any high levels of uric acid. Have you had gout or anything along the way?
No, I had gout years ago, but everything's come back fine with the blood test.
Okay. All right.
It's just swollen and it's bright red, my knee. And
well, that's inflamed.
Yeah.
That I'd be surprised if there's not some sort of gouty activity around there. I know a little bit about that myself, having had an example of that many, many years ago. Redness, heat and swelling and pain sometimes are related to a gouty condition, which would show up in most cases in a blood test. I think you need to run that past your GP, but I'll be quick and say that you might get some benefit from a herb called Devil's Claw. Now, I know that's a terrible name, but Devil's Claw, or botanically known as Harpagophytum, is called up in the British Herbal Pharmacopoeia as a herb with the specificity as an oral supplement for sciatica. Now, that is usually taken in conjunction with an American herb called black cohosh.
Yep.
Those two herbs are frequently prescribed in combination in a liquid preparation or a liquid tonic in the right dosage, and usually work as mild analgesics and with some anti-inflammatory characteristics. If you're not using those, I suggest you see a compounding pharmacist or a herbalist, someone who might be able to put that together for you. You can buy them separately as an encapsulated or tableted preparation, so long as you take them in the right dosage. But very quickly also, I would say, preparation incorporating, something like capsicum, the oleoresin of capsicum, with some arnica in a product, say something like Stiff Sore and Sorry. If you haven't used that topically, that is by putting it on the areas that are sore and swollen, you might be missing out on some things.
All right, we'll run out of time. Dennis, thank you so much.
Yeah, good program.
Yep, another Health program. Naturally next week. Yeah. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from 2NURFM at the University of Newcastle. You'll find them all at 2NURFM.com.